honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Navy pilot Tad Riley, now 94 years old. But in the photo he and I are looking at, he was only 32, standing in front of a row of RF-8 Crusaders about 10 or 15 yards from the Commander-in-Chief, the President of the United States. You can find this photo at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, but I'll have Tad explain it for us.
This is a picture of President Kennedy, who awarded Light Photographic Squadron 62, the Navy unit citation for their operations during the missile crisis. It's the first time that the Navy unit citation was ever given in peacetime, and it was the first time, at least so far that I know of, that the president personally awarded it.
That makes it pretty special.
It was at the time, yes. He came to see us. He didn't come to see anybody else.
Did you get to shake his hand?
No. He got in his car, and US-1 was just down the street.
And your Distinguished Flying Cross citation doesn't say anything about what you did. Why not?
Well, it was all classified, and they wanted to reward us, but they couldn't admit it.
But all these decades later, it's not all classified. So you can tell us this story of the important photographs you snapped over those targets that you told us about earlier in Cuba in October 1962.
Everything was no radios. We're all light signals when we took off all together and headed off on our way. And we were stay under 500 feet so we wouldn't tractor our missiles, go as fast as we wanted to. Well, at that time, we only thought the Cubans had MiG-17s, which is a good airplane, but it was no match for us. We could cruise faster than they could dive, practically. So we were humming along about 600 miles an hour to 100 feet, and there was a factory along the coast. When you're going to fly low level over land at high speeds, you got to know where you started. That whole north coast is just nothing but white beaches. But on the map, there was one mark there that showed there was a high point. So I figured that must be something. And it turned out it was an old factory, probably an old rum factory. And that was my starting point. And from then on, we didn't have any GPSs and things like that in those days. It was a compass and a sweep second hand. And you knew how fast you were going, 5 miles a minute or whatever it was. And we headed off. And sure, the first thing I knew, we flew right over a surface-to-air missile site. It was Russian, and that they have a control van with 6 rockets around it. And when I went by, most of the boys were up on top of the van sunbathing, and the rest of them were playing volleyball. And so I knew we're okay today. They don't know we're coming. I mean, now you could kind of take a deep. That told me that we didn't have to worry about their defensive systems because they were still playing volleyball. But I just waved my wings and kept on going, and I had my number 2 man was right in back of me when we were radio silence until we were over land. Then we could talk to each other. But we kept going, and about the next thing, I was getting close to where I was supposed to find something, and I saw piles of big fence posts piled up. Was what they were doing was building a security fence around their missile site. But they were big white, they must have been cast concrete posts. And that looked suspicious, because Cuba was really third world. Very few of the roads were paved, and they were just dirt. There were the highest thing were the palm trees and steeples. There were no telephone lines, no power lines, so we didn't have to worry about it. That we would have had in the States, for instance. You'd sure be worried about power lines. So we were just humming along. About 300 feet was about as low as you could still navigate, see what was ahead. And so sure enough, there were over to the side there were a bunch of bulldozers, and there was a lot of dirt, and they were digging. And we took the picture that you've got there and made a run. And there were some very long, skinny tents. That's where they had the missiles there, As I went by, one of them, the nose was sticking out, and these were the big ones. These are the ones you see on the newsreels on May Day parades that they drag. I mean, they're 85 feet long. These were the big ones. Found out afterwards they could have gotten to Seattle. And then I took those pictures and went up to the air base, and I made a pass down their runway. And they have about 90, a whole bunch of airplanes, but they had no hangars. It was just a big, long runway and parking ramps. And all the airplanes had canvas-fitted covers. So I never saw an airplane. I just saw you couldn't see what kind they were, but they were obviously swept-wing fighters, about 90 of them, they said later when they counted them. And then I went up to Remedios, and that base was more in the forest, a bunch of palm trees and stuff. It didn't stand out in the open like the first one. They had just started, I think. As it turned out there, those are intermediate or small missiles. They could get to Washington, but maybe as far as St. Louis. But they weren't nearly as in progress. And that was really what I don't think Washington, they had evidence of a lot of stuff going on, and they couldn't figure out what it possibly, I don't think they believed they would try to put these big missiles in there. I just don't think they believed it. But that's my personal opinion.
Sure.
And they had really, that was a major effort for what the Russians did. It's pretty amazing that they got all that. Everything they needed was there, and they were going to throw it together in a hurry. Well, they got caught. So when we came back, we landed at Navy Jacksonville. That's where our big photo lab was. And they grabbed the film and developed it and then put it on a bomber and took it up to Washington, I guess, or the UN. That's where it ended up. We didn't fly the next day because they're still processing the film, and the interpreters were figuring out what they had. So then the next day, that was about Saturday, and things were really humming, and the Russians had finally said they were going to back out and leave. So it came along with what they later called, we found out they call it Black Saturday. That was the next morning, and we flew the same mission. And I could see things were different. They looked like they were loading. And the reason I'm mentioning this that night, I was at home again. This is a good war because I stayed at home for and the phone rang, and someone told me they obviously knew I was Red 5. We could use our own call signs. I was Red Y, Red 2, I guess. Somebody else was white, and red, white, and blue, and that's the way. And this guy on the phone obviously was in on it, so I could talk to him. And he said, "We hold the line. We want to transfer this phone." The next thing I heard was the White House. And the next voice was a distinctly Boston, New England voice. He didn't identify himself, but he said, "Did they look like they were leaving?" And I said, "It looked like they were loading trucks." And he says, "Thank God." I'm going to say this, and I'm going to stick with my story, but I'm pretty sure that was Bobby Kennedy. It was a very distinct Boston accent. I've spent a lot of time in New England. They're all a little different. So anyway, that pretty much, after that, we flew missions for a while. Because we could count the missiles. They were all out in the open at that one base I had. We knew how many they had, and so we were tracking them as they drug them down to Cienfuego to load them to go home. And the whole rig was 85 feet long. And you're going down through little, I don't know how they got them there in the first place. But they could only go about 10, 15 miles a day. They could only go about 10 miles an hour with this big thing. And they'd camp and get up in the morning and load up and go again. So we knew about how far they'd gone. So we were tracking each missile that we knew they had. We could keep track of it, make sure they took them out. pretty after that, it was kind of winding down, just watching them.
And so that was your microscopic view of what's happening. But if we zoom out, the world is waiting to see. I mean, are we going to have nuclear war with the USSR? Are they really going to attack us? What's going on? And you ended up seeing one of those photos you had taken being held up at the UN on television?
Yes, the one that ended up in on the cover. Well, it ended up in several magazines and so forth, because it really showed more than some of the others. There, some of the other pictures, you just saw trucks out in the woods, and obviously they've been making launch pads and so forth, but that picture kind of tied it all together.
And I'll put this picture online at hometownheroesradio.com, but as I understand, you got home from one of your flights, and you go back home in Jacksonville where your wife is waiting for you, and she's got Adlai Stevenson on the TV talking about this?
They started showing pictures, and one of them was this picture, which I had taken about 4 hours earlier.
So what did she say?
Well, she was surprised, of course. I don't remember. I was just glad to be there. I had been gone a couple of days, and the kids wanted to know what's going on. just another day.
Well, and I'm guessing because of the secret nature of all this, you couldn't confirm nor deny that you had taken any of those.
They wanted to keep quiet who the pilots were, because there was always the possibility of retaliation and families and that sort of thing. So we didn't want our names broadcast.
You think your wife knew that was some of your work?
She must have. She knows everything.
Well, and, you know, I'm just curious, because it's been 60 years since this happened, almost 62 it'll be this year. Have you ever thought what might have been different if you guys weren't there to take those photos when you took them?
I personally think we came a lot closer than they've ever even admitted. Because, you know, if you're the guy down at the bottom and you see something happen and maybe you don't think you're quite ready, you make sure you are ready. And there were people, there were little activities going on that you never saw before.
Yeah, and we talk so much about the things that happened, but not so much about the things that came really close to happening. So what I hear you saying is we were probably a lot more to global nuclear conflict than any of us have ever really imagined.
Well, it wouldn't have been us. It would have been them. They were helpless, and they knew it, and we outgunned them.
Now, I understand, too, on one of these flights down in that neck of the woods, you got a little surprise from some MiGs that you didn't know were there?
Yeah, it was while we were doing this road reconnaissance, tracking the missiles. The pressure was off at that point. It was kind of loose, and we were flying a little higher because it was hard to see this equipment down in the woods if you were too low. And my wingman called out. There were two MiGs making a run on us. And I looked up, and they were MiG-21s. At that time, none of the satellites had MiG-21s. That was the number one airplane around Moscow. The satellites had MiG-19s, which was about like F-100. It was capable of going supersonic, but it wasn't. But the MiG-21 was comparable to what I was flying. And it might have made a difference if we had known. We might have done things a little different if we'd known they had MiG-21s. And not only that, they weren't, I don't know, maybe I was naive, but I just assumed if we saw a MiG, it'd be a Cuban. But these were obviously Russian pilots. They weren't Cubans. And that's a different ball game.
So it was two of your F-8s with two MiG-21s on your tail?
Yeah, one. After the Soviet Union collapse, they got some of the pilots' flight reports, and it was the commanding officer, and I don't remember, it was Colonel Bumboff or something like that, and he was leading a student just checking out in a MiG-21. And so after the first pass, we countered, and I never saw the second guy again, whether he just got lost or what. The colonel kept with us, but we got down. We were going supersonic, and we were in the trees. Some of those palm trees are about 100 feet high, and so we could get, I figured if he'd chase us through the woods, be my guest, because I was having enough trouble just missing him, much less trying to shoot at somebody. And he chased us probably 20 or 30 miles, and then he was just told to scare us away. Well, he did.
And maybe that answers a little of my question, but I mean, I don't know what your rules of engagement were, but I mean, that sounds like a pretty hairy situation.
Well, we were on that. We didn't have any guns or anything. We only had cameras. So about the only thing we could do is use tactics. And at that time, I knew we had trouble with our sidewinders and rocket heat-seeking, looking down at a moving target. They couldn't lock onto it. It would be too much stuff.
And to clarify, so you're saying your plane had no defenses, but you knew that the American versions of those kind of heat-seeking missiles were not entirely accurate, so you're thinking maybe theirs aren't either?
I figured they have the same problems that we did. And so I figured if we got down low and went as fast as we could, that part worked. I don't think he could have gotten to us anyway, but it was a rough flight because you get down low like that and it's hot down there and you have shadows and so forth and plowed fields and green fields. And so you get a little thermals of rising hot air. And when the way we were going is like running across a whole bunch of railroad tracks with flat tires. I mean, I couldn't even read the instruments. It was just bouncing around. So we got up about Mach 1.2, and that's all I wanted to go. I was afraid the airplane would come apart.
Well, much less you might hit a tree or something else, huh?
Well, you could dodge them. You could see. But, I mean, I actually... Well, one time we were going along down across a valley, and up ahead was a ridge, maybe 15 or 20 feet, with palm trees along the top, and there was a break in they weren't solid. There was an opening, and I kind of looked at it and figured out I could go between. I wouldn't have to go up over it. And so as I got there, there were two Mexicans wearing sombreros. One was sitting on a mule, and the other guy was standing there. I'll say he was talking to his friend, but I'm not sure that's exactly what he was doing. Well, we went by him, probably 15 or 20 feet, supersonic. And I imagine that mule's still out there twitching someplace. That could actually do a job on your eardrums.
Yeah.
So I don't know, they neither one of them saw me coming, and they couldn't hear me, of course. So I often wondered what the results of that, because I was just as far as across the room from him.
And again, I'm just trying to relate this and put myself in your shoes. So you have this incident with the MiGs where you don't know how that's going to end up. If you're going to get away, if they're going to shoot you down, you can't shoot back. And then you get back home and you see your wife. And again, you can't tell her anything about that, right?
By that time, it was pretty open.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about it. I mean, there's no way too many people knew about it by then.
Can you describe the adrenaline or the emotion that you feel in a circumstance like that?
Well, you just kind of feel relieved. I mean, you got away with that one. You wonder what the next one's going to be.
Yeah. Well, and I guess I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask if there are some other next ones that you wanted to share with us.
I don't think so. That was the most exciting time of my life, and it's been dull ever since.
One thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us a story that I know nobody else could tell us. When you think back of all your years flying in the Navy, is there something you would say you're most proud of?
I guess I'm alive. It was a job, like anything else. You kind of took it for granted. It was a lot of fun.
So how would you explain the significance of that week in October of 1962 and what you did and what the world learned?
Well, it could have been World War III, real easy. When I look back, somewhere along the line, some people could have made a snap decision and started something that they didn't anticipate. And that's some of the stuff that's going on now. I don't think they really realize They think they have all the answers, and they don't. They're not smart enough to know they don't know. They think they know.
Words of caution from Tad Riley, 94-year-old retired Navy pilot. Again, if you want to explore more of Tad's story with photos and a short video, you can find all of that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.